It was early 1982. The new year had dawned. The stormy sea and sky were painted warship grey by day, and the outside air temperature was low enough to freeze the proverbials off a monkey. My Sea Harrier squadron was embarked in HMS Invincible off the field-ridden coast of Norway. And in spite of the chillingly unfriendly weather, NATO exercise Alloy Express was going well. Our new aircraft had proved itself to be a reliable and effective fleet defence all-weather fighter by day and night, but was now being asked to operate in sea and weather conditions that prevented even the mighty USS Nimitz from conducting flying operations. Whether nuking her bulk through the ocean at more than 40 knots, or, as she was now, pitching like a bitch as she battled with the elements, she was a magnificent sight. These war-fighting exercises were realistic enough, but when the weather deteriorated beyond reason in peacetime, there was little sense, even for Nimitz, to risk losing aircraft by operating beyond the limits of prudence. The smaller, graceful Invincible seemed almost like a destroyer escort beside the mammoth US carrier, but rode the sea better and had a fighter on board that could be pushed harder when it came to bad weather. The subdued deck lighting was less welcoming than usual as I went on deck, found my aircraft in the gale force, wet murk, and then strained against goon suit, G-suit and life preserver to get my right leg high enough to reach the bottom rung of the Sea Harrier cockpit access ladder. Above me, the night sky over the North Norwegian Sea was as black as the Ace of Spades. The sea surface was barely visible in the rain, but was in turmoil. There was no visual horizon, making recovery on board more trying, and the aircraft creaked up and down on its oleos as the ship twisted and buffeted its way through the gale. I put the pass behind me as I started the sea jet, positioned for takeoff on the wet, windswept runway, and launched from the deck in high dudgeon. I returned an hour and a half later to carry out the land-on in atrocious conditions. There was no horizon at all. The rain on the windscreen caused a distracting deformation of the ship's usually welcoming lights, and I could feel the heavy buffeting from the gale force winds. Invincible was rolling, weaving, pitching, and heaving. And as she was my only source of visual reference, this made the land-on task more onerous. At least it was a bit of a challenge, and added spice to what had otherwise been a totally boring flight. Swearing under my breath at wings and the world, I stabilized the aircraft over the deck amidships as best I could. The superstructure of the ship's island was only a matter of feet to the right, and as the ship rolled heavily to port, the huge wall of grey metal seemed to approach ominously close to the wingtip. Maintaining a steady hover was more like flying in formation on an unwilling leader. So eventually I took pot luck, selected a firm rate of descent, and waited for the heavier-than-usual touchdown as the deck came up to meet me. A jarring thud, and I was there. There must be more to life than this, I thought. Little did I know then that trouble was brewing in the Falkland Islands, and we could soon bring me what I had always wanted, the chance to see some real action. By mid-March, we had disembarked to Yeovilton and were preparing for Easter leave. Then, out of the blue, all squadron commanding officers received a secret communication from the First Sea Lord. It warned us that our squadron should be kept ready for any eventuality, and personnel going on leave overseas should be prepared for a rapid recall to duty. Initially, I had no idea of what was about to take place, but a bit of thought, coupled with media emphasis, soon brought the South Atlantic into focus. The orders were clear enough. We might be off to war.